It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And George Yancey is back with us now. The Emory University philosophy professor has a new book called Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Race in America. It's the story of an open letter he published on the New York Times philosophy site, The Stone, in 2015, maybe you read it, called Dear White America and the Backlash It Provoked. In brief, the letter contains an admission that as a man in our society, he is sexist, despite not wanting to oppress women, that despite his best intentions, he perpetuates sexism every day of his life. And he invites white people to open themselves up to viewing themselves in a similar way with respect to racism, that is, to allow themselves to be vulnerable, to be unsutured, he says, to let go of white innocence and go beyond acknowledging white privilege, beyond even engaging in anti-racism work, to another level of what it means to be an ally and to a deep kind of love. He frames it in terms of love. So we'll talk about all that and the ugly backlash, too, that provoked the title of the book. This is the latest book in Professor Yancey's body of work that also includes writing or editing other books in the field of whiteness studies, such as White Self-Criticality Beyond Anti-Racism, How Does It Feel to Be a White Problem, from 2014, Christology and Whiteness, What Would Jesus Do, and others. So, Professor Yancey, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you've been here before talking about the ideas in the letter, but can we talk about it again before we get to the backlash and maybe some other things from your body of work? I took a stab at characterizing the letter there, but would you build on that or correct it if need be?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think what you said was accurate. And of course, backlash is an extension of that that letter, Dear White America. So in that regard, backlash continues this theme of a letter of love, of course, to white people. And by a letter of love with Dear White America or now with backlash, I didn't mean anything like a sort of Hollywood sentimentality. I meant what bell hooks says when she says that love is telling the truth to ourselves and sharing that truth with others, or where Baldwin says that love refuses to wear the masks that we're afraid we cannot live without and know we cannot live with. So it's really a way of presenting ourselves and developing and cultivating forms of vulnerability, which means the capacity to be wounded regarding the truth about, in this case, white racism and the way in which that racism continues to exist well into the 21st century and the ways in which black bodies and bodies of color continue to suffer because of that whiteness. And of course, by whiteness, by white privilege, I don't mean the Klan. I never meant neo-Nazis. I meant everyday loving white folk, white Christians, for an example, who have really good intentions, but who nonetheless embody certain forms of racialized implicit biases, those who've internalized racism, and those who are part of a system, let's call it white supremacy, that privileges them in ways that inevitably oppresses people of color.
Can you explain the I am sexist analogy a little more? You wrote, I'm going to read people a little more of this from the book. You wrote, every day of my life, I fight against the dominant male narrative, choosing to see women as subjects, not objects. But just because I fight against sexism does not give me clean hands. I continue to oppress. Now, I collapsed some sentences there for brevity, so tell me if I got the right idea. But
no.
Go ahead.
Sure. That's absolutely right. I mean, so, and of course, it was controversial, right? I mean, here, philosophers, for an example, we don't like to think about ourselves as being embodied. We don't like to think about ourselves as being sort of ensconced within structural forms of evil, structural forms of injustice, because we're abstract minds somehow. But what I wanted to do is to make it clear that, and really what it was, it's a sort of olive branch. It was a way of, how do I communicate effectively with white people to get them to look at their own racism? Well, why not present myself as vulnerable? Why not risk the possibility of being wounded publicly by talking about my own sexism or by, as it were, coming out as a sexist? And what I meant by that is that, look, in a society that is predicated on certain rigid gender norms, a society that is predicated on male gazes that fragment and pornography women's bodies, I, too, have internalized that toxicity, that poison. I, too, am part of a system that oppresses women, and my hands are therefore not clean. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm, for an example, Harvey Weinstein. It doesn't mean that I'm allegedly putting pills into women's drinks like Bill Cosby, but that doesn't free me from the ways in which I continue to perpetuate gendered oppression with respect to women. So, I mean, I think it takes fearless speech. I think it takes a certain kind of paresia, which is the Greek term, to talk about one's own sexism, to out one, and to realize that we are broken, we are fragmented as men. We have internalized forms of machismo and forms of pornographic imaginary that strips women of a certain kind of bodily integrity. So when I say that I'm a sexist, I mean precisely that. So even as I try for the rest of my life to undo my sexism, some of that stuff is so sedimented in my psyche and the way in which I am situated as a male within a culture that's predicated upon male patriarchy. I cannot possibly escape that in a day's work. It will take a lifetime for me to undo the violence, right, that has been done to me through structures of male power.
So to come back to race, you seem to be writing, and I think you were indicating this a minute ago, largely to more liberal whites who already hate the KKK, hate how Trump uses racism so casually and cruelly, things like that, and are aware that they have all kinds of unearned white privilege. You're pushing the idea beyond those things to some kind of greater awakening?
Absolutely. And so Cornel West, for example, just to skip ahead a bit, who wrote the foreword to the book, the title of his foreword is The End of White Innocence. Of course, that's what I'm saying in the book. And I'm following Baldwin there. It's not something original with me, but I guess it's original or at least forceful with me in terms of me during the 21st century trying to push this idea. That's right. There is no white innocence. And by that, I understand that all white people are not part of the Klan or neo-Nazis. That would be ridiculous to make such a claim. I know that there are also white people who were against what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia. But here's my point. My point is that those who were against what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, those whites, they too need to think about critically and honestly the ways in which their whiteness implicates them nevertheless in a system, so hence it's systemic, a systemic form of white privilege and white power, a kind of privilege that renders them immune to the political, social, and even existential ways in which black people and people of color suffer from a certain kind of racialized dis-ease. So what I want then is for even those quote-unquote good whites to begin to think about the ways in which they are not innocent. And as Baldwin says, innocence is the crime. Right? It's precisely one trying to lay claim to that idea that one is innocent. So just as I am a sexist, in as much as I've internalized that sexism and am part of a system, so too even those whites who consider themselves anti-racists are also racists. Right? So I claim that the best that white people can be are anti-racist racists. So the best that I can be then is an anti-sexist sexist.
And to do what with that ultimately, for you as an anti-sexist sexist or for white people who may be those who are anti-racist racists?
Yes. And I think that part of coming to terms with that is the honesty. I mean, that's what we need to do. We need to tarry and carry the weight of that honesty. So those whites who consider themselves to be moral, ethical, I'm not denying that. Those men who consider themselves to be on the side of women, et cetera, what I want to do is say there's more to be thought about here. It's not just a quick disclosure that you are fighting on the side, fighting on behalf of women or fighting on behalf of black people and people of color. It's also to tarry with the other layer that you're missing. So often I put it this way. I will argue that, for an example, Anderson Cooper on CNN, he will often have black pundits on and they'll all agree about something. Let's say they all agree that what happened in Charlottesville is egregious, atrocious. But that's part of the discussion. That's the spectacular forms of racism. I think what would be far more profound and far more provocative if Anderson Cooper were to say something like, but you know, I too am a racist. Surely I'm not like those in Charlottesville, right? But I have internalized the toxicity of racism, and it gets expressed at a very daily, quotidian way. And I'm also part of a system that oppresses people. So I think that what I really want in the end is something far more freeing and liberatory, but must be preceded by a level of honesty where we take on the gravitas of what it means to be complicated and what it means to be complicit with forms of racialized injustice or gendered injustice.
My guest is Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey, whose new book is called Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. And to the point of backlash, before we get to your description of some of what you got after that Dear White America letter in the New York Times, I'll note that I wanted to let people hear you for a while before I gave out the phone number to maybe have part of a conversation with you. But all 10 of our lines are already full with people who've been hearing and know the number or looked up the number, which might be an indication of what kind of a backlash. I don't know yet if they're going to be supportive or or in what percentages, but let's get to the backlash, remembering that there are words we can't say on the radio. What was the intensity and what was the volume of it like to that original New York Times article?
Absolutely. So the article came out on New Year's on Christmas Eve, and which was quite prophetic, actually, only because I referred to the letter as a gift to white people. So it came out on Christmas Eve. Of course, people waking up to Christmas morning. A very religious, obviously, holiday or holy day. And there they had to read and face this letter called Dear White America, which asked them to grapple with their racism. Shortly thereafter, of course, I got white vitriolic responses in the form of voicemails at my university, snail mail. I got postcards that were actually sent to me, letters actually written to me, and white supremacists or alt-right websites discussed the piece. And let me first, in advance, apologize to those African Americans who might be listening, because I'm about to use that that horrible racial and racist epithet. But just to give you a sense, for an example, I've been called nigger so many times that I can't even count them. On one website, someone wrote simply this: nigger, 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 nigger. And it went on and on, right? Just simply down the page. I was called a pavement ape, a hood rat. Someone said that I ought to be beheaded ISIS style, and then said, make America white again. I was called a colored monkey. I was told that I wrote the letter Dear White America because I wanted to sleep with white women. Now, just imagine what that means. Someone said that they wanted that I might find myself on a cold slab if I keep talking, and they wanted to shut my mouth permanently, to close it permanently. And there's something quite profound in this animalistic imagery and this kind of violence, because I didn't anticipate that. I mean, I knew that there would be disagreement. I knew that there might be some anger. But I didn't anticipate the full range and arsenal of white supremacist ideas that would and hatred that would be directed toward me. It was as if we were pulling from, you know, the pre-1960s or something. And if anything, what backlash is about and what is clearly demonstrable to me is that we do not live in a post-racial America. And in fact, in many ways, the responses that I got confirm precisely what I was after in Dear White America, that white people have to come to terms with their racism. And it wasn't just racialized epithets. There were even readers and responders to the letter who said that I somehow am making Martin Luther King ashamed, like I'm shaming him because of what I'm saying. But Martin Luther King actually believed, in fact, he said that the vast majority of white people are racist, either consciously or unconsciously. So people weren't even reading the full power of Martin Luther King's message. Yeah, Dr. King.
Can you talk more about what in that backlash surprised you? Because we know what people wrote about Obama on social media for 8 years. We know what the election of Trump seems to have brought to the surface from a little more underground, maybe. I realize this letter was during that campaign. It was Christmas 2015, so it was still an early phase, but Trump had certainly broken out as the Republican leader with the racialized campaign that he was running. And I'm sure you've been racistly trolled before. So I'm curious if there was anything new that you learned from this particular experience.
Yeah, that's good. In fact, some white supremacist websites had already had pictures of Donald Trump smiling as they were calling me nigger. And I think for me, what was new about this is it's just the realization that of how it is that white America is not prepared to face its own monsters. It's not prepared to face the reality of one's own racism, no matter how subtle, no matter how insidious, and at the same time to pull from. I mean, this was surprising to me, to pull from what you would think has already died in some sense, pull from a reservoir, to pull from a subterranean space of such racialized imagery, animalistic imagery of me, right, to use that language to impact me. And then it wasn't just that, but it was the sheer range and the sheer volume of it, right? And the way in which it was just unconscionable to me that in 2015, now, of course, in 2017-18, I'm still getting this. I mean, just about 2 weeks or 3 weeks ago, someone called the dean's secretary and said, and I can't repeat, well, we'll repeat part of it, said that I'm coming to get that nigger, quote-unquote, nigger Yancey, and then said something about other expletives were used to knock his head off, and I'm coming now, right now, which required police presence again for me. And, I mean, I'm thinking, okay, here we are in the 21st century, and we can't have a decent discussion, an honest, a vulnerable discussion about racism. And I don't think that's going to happen. It didn't happen under Obama's 8-year tenure, and it will certainly not happen under Trump's administration.
You do also write in the book about some white readers of the letter who got it and wrote positive comments. Let me read part of one of them. Somebody wrote, "I was highly skeptical about this article as I read through it. I wasn't convinced that we should accept the language of white privilege and those who passively benefit from it as being an equivalent to racism. However, the last line punched me in the chest. Your line was, I want you to imagine that your child is black. And the reader says, that sold me on this argument completely. Until this point, I've always considered myself as extremely progressive." So would you like to comment on that or other positive responses?
Absolutely. And I really love that one. It was very powerful and it's very moving to me. And we should note that there were many whites who had the desire to become what I call unsutured, which is just a complicated way of saying to become vulnerable, to open up to the letter, to be open to the gift of Dear White America, and by extension, to open themselves up to the text backlash. And some whites even said, look, I'm not a racist. And then they would say, right after that, they would say, I lied to myself. So in the very same sentence, they were constructing this narrative of themselves as being beyond the muck and mire of racism. And then they would confess, right, to their own racism. And I think that was important to me. It helped to buttress a certain kind of hope. And while I'm not optimistic, if hope means staring in the face of the abyss, right, and not knowing what's going to happen next, then I am hopeful. And what those letters did is they said to me that there are white allies out there, but white allies who were prepared to say, look, I'm not static in my being a white ally. I'm still in process. I will still, even as I recognize my own racism, even as that last line which says, now imagine that your child is black, these white people understood that they still have work to do. So there was no place called arrival for them. And I believe that to be an anti-racist white is not to arrive. It's to constantly be in process of undoing one's white supremacy. So for me, there is no place called arrival with respect to my anti-sexism. I'm always, and will probably go to my grave, undoing the ways in which male patriarchy and androcentricity have become toxic in my life.
We'll continue in a minute with Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey, his new book, Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. And we'll take just maybe a couple of those unsolicited calls that are coming in. My interest in having you on is not at all to start an argument with people who are having snap judgments about what you wrote or what you're saying. Just the opposite. I think that there are so many people hearing you for the first time. Mm. I think with what you're presenting, I'd rather people sit with this and come to whatever conclusions they come to about it over time and more slowly. But we'll take a few phone calls. And then I also want to ask you about this book and this sort of experiment in the Times on their philosophy page. In the context of you as a philosophy professor, because that's different from a political science professor or an Africana studies professor or something like that. And I think that's really interesting. So we'll continue in a minute with George Yancey. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey. And his new book, with a foreword by Cornel West, is called Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America. It includes the original text of his Dear White America letter that was published Christmas 2015 in the New York Times on their philosophy page, The Stone, and the backlash to it. And Maggie in Sunnyside, you're on WNYC with George Yancey. Hello, Maggie.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just instantly compelled to call in when I heard the conversation, just to express my gratitude for this entire perspective around racism and sexism. I am a white woman. I grew up in the Midwest, and since living in New York and really just being a part of just all of the social impact that's happening in conversation right now, I've really been doing a lot of just self-analysis around my privilege and my whiteness. And one thing that I feel has been a helpful tool for me is to view my own gender and to see the anger and frustration and some of just the constant existence of sexism and how it will be with me my entire life. And to kind of use that as a tool to understand, even though I am definitely not in the same existence of Black America, but to relate in one element to the anger and just the big overbearing, you know, feeling of frustration that every generation of minorities have felt in this country. And so I'm just very appreciative, and I wanted to voice that gratitude, and I very much so look forward to reading this book. So thank you.
Professor Yancey, anything you want to say? That was easy.
Yeah, that was pretty easy, and thank you, Maggie, for that. I think it's very fearless, in some sense courageous, for you to talk about that, and I think you're right. I think that it's important that women, if I got you correctly, need to think about very critically. And, of course, we are doing that in the Me Too movement. But, of course, I think we also need to think about the way in which certain voices, women of color, their voices have been marginalized in the We Too movement. And we have to think about the intersections between racism and sexism. But I really appreciate the way in which you're taking your own sexualized identity and thinking about it critically in terms of how male hegemony operates.
This one might be a little harder. Joe in Syosset, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just have to express my frustration because it seems like when I hear people talk about racism, it's always just such a one-sided affair. And if a stranger or if an outsider, so to speak, if it's possible that there would be one, would be listening, it basically sounds like there's 150 million white supremacists in this country, and all they want to do is have black people go away. And I just think it's disingenuous to talk in terms of it. Just again, I know the professor is not stating that all white people are racist, but it sure sounds like that, and it gets frustrating to someone like me, a white male who tries my best. I guess we all have our prejudices, inside, and we try to overcome that, and it's just frustrating. I don't know if he's got a comment on that.
I absolutely do. Thank you, Joe, for that. I just wanted to say a couple of things. One, I think that frustration is an important place to begin a dialogue, so I appreciate your call. But just know that for some of us in this country, for well over 300 years, we have been frustrated. And we've been frustrated because white America has denigrated us. White America has dehumanized us. White America does not see us as valuable. And this is why you have Black Lives Matter. You don't have a White Lives Matter movement because it is obvious to America that white lives matter, right? And I wanted to say to you, of course, I'm not saying that white people are like the Klan or like neo-Nazis. And you have to remember that although I am black, I identify as black, there's Robert Jensen, who's a white scholar, who says that every time he walks into a store and along with a black man, and the black man is followed, he, Robert Jensen, is benefiting from systemic racialized privilege. You have a white woman whose name is Stephanie Wildman, and she says that white people don't want to admit it, but we are all racist. This is what she says. She says, and we ought to admit it. That would be the first step toward a certain form of liberation. And she says that she is racist precisely because white supremacy and white privilege are systemic. So it's not as if Dr. Yancey, right, as a black professor, is somehow a race baiter. I'm not doing that at all. That is a waste of my time. In fact, many students will ask me, why do you take your time talking to white people when they won't listen or when they will misunderstand you? But I do this out of love, that powerful love that Baldwin talks about. And I also do it for my own children. I do it for those white children who have not completely, as it were, or who have not internalized certain kinds of those forms of racist toxicity. So what I want to say to you then, if you're frustrated, I would suggest that you look at those white people who are white like you, who in fact have a very different view on their own racism and who in fact see themselves as racist.
Joe, thank you very much for your call. What would you say to those critics, and I think there are a few, who say there might be some other means to the same end, that by framing it in terms of white people accepting their own racism rather than more specific, you know, attitudes and the types of implicit biases that they're likely to encounter in their own brains and things like that you're unnecessarily putting people on the defensive.
Sure. And, of course, I also talk about that. I also talk about unconscious racism. I also talk about the ways in which white racism is internalized, and it happens in a way that is unintentional or unconscious or non-voluntary. I think that's very important. And I've had this question before, and my answer is something like this. I'd rather speak the truth and to speak it in the most harsh form that I can speak it, because given where we are in this country and the moral crisis that I think we're undergoing, I think the last thing that we need is to be gentle about these issues. So the brutalness of the message, right, where I'm saying that, look, let's think about the ways in which you continue, white people continue to benefit from a white supremacist society. Let's think about the ways in which you are complicit with that, and therefore you too are racist, while at the same time making sure that white people don't become completely defensive. So I want to make that distinction between the Klan and good white folk. But at the same time, I want to say that it's less a question of kind and more a question of degree. I mean, it would be like talking to Germans during Hitler's Third Reich and asking them, what are you doing against Adolf Hitler, right, to help Jews? I mean, Karl Jaspers, the philosopher, said that Germans are guilty precisely because they live. Because they got to live, they are guilty. Abraham Joshua Heschel says that some of us are guilty, but all of us are responsible. So what I want to do is to speak that, to speak fearlessly and to say that life is short, right? I mean, in 100 years, everyone listening at the moment, including me, including you, we will be dead, right? We will be gone. So the question is, what can we do between birth and the grave that can be so phenomenal, that can be so incredibly beautiful that we transform the world? And so that's why I go with the more direct parhesiastic approach.
So last question. You're a philosophy professor, and you write that this book, while being about this very concrete experience you've had and the very concrete experiences of people in America, is still largely a philosophy book. What context would you put it in terms of the study of philosophy?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I would put it within the context of St. Augustine. And why do I say that? Because St. Augustine was a philosopher who refused not to weep. And I would like to think that philosophy for me is not so much a site of wonder, although it's still that. Philosophy has become for me a site of suffering because it's holding on to all of those issues like why are we here? What is the meaning of human existence? Does God exist? What is the meaning of death? All of those questions carry a deep and profound existential gravitas. But once philosophers move beyond those traditional questions and begin to explore issues, let's say, of whiteness, of racism, of sexism, the level of suffering that begins to accumulate there is often so unbearable, so traumatic. So while the text is philosophical, and as much as I use certain philosophical terms, philosophical ideas, I attempt to humanize that text because philosophy often doesn't have a human face. I humanize it precisely through providing a narrative of my own suffering, my own trauma, through what I'd call white backlash.
Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey, as a follow-up to his New York Times op-ed Christmas 2015 on their philosophy site called The Stone, the letter called Dear White America, a book-length treatment that includes the letter and so much response that he got, as well as analysis of it. The book is called Backlash, What Happens When We Talk Honestly About Racism in America, with a foreword by Cornel West. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.